that on full screen. Okay, so I always start my presentations with acknowledging how I'm feeling. So I like to do a body check. My heart is beating very fast. And my stomach is quite tight. And mentally, I feel very full. I feel like I've engaged with a lot that's happened. And I also like to invite people to acknowledge that we only have 25 black female professors in the UK. And that through their hard labour, there's a reason why I get to be a black female PhD student. So my name is Janine, and I'm going to be talking to you originally about a presentation that I rehearsed meticulously, but that's gone. Partly because I'm very highly influenced by what's been discussed today, and I wanted to respond to that. Let's see how this goes. I've got 20 minutes. So originally the title was From Safe Spaces to Brave Spaces, and it forms part of my own PhD. I'm in my last year, and it's actually a collaborative programme between the University of Bedfordshire and Tate. I'm based in the learning department, and specifically with the Schools and Teachers team. And the idea is looking at whether Tate can be seen as a safe space originally. I then challenged my supervisors to do safer, which I hopefully will be able to articulate throughout this presentation. And then I've completely abandoned anything to do with safety to think about bravery instead. So that's kind of roughly be the journey that I'm going to walk us through. So I also intentionally use garish colours and awful text to start challenging what a presentation looks like. So if you can't read anything, it's intentional. So that's kind of my main research question, which I have to stick with. I can't change it. The funders said no, but you know, I have 80,000 words to play with. So the main objective originally was to kind of do action research with the schools and teachers team, do workshops with that particular team, and then also work with educators that are engaging with their programs to think about people who are working in secondary schools, people working in further education. So in that department, they only work with the school age of 10 to 18. So the educators that I come into contact with are people teaching primary to further education. So I've done numerous kind of follow-on workshops with these educators, most of whom are white women, to really think about their positionality regarding race, cultural differences, and ethnicity. But I'm not talking to you about that, because that's what I was going to talk to you about. So I use critical race theory, which is a complete no-no in the UK. What is critical race theory? Probably people might even be asking. I also actively do not cite anyone who's not a white man, apart from Walter Malolo, but he's technically Argentinian from the Global South. So there's a lot of challenges that I experience, not from my own supervisors, but from when I'm constantly having to prove my academic work, prove my credibility as a black woman, theorising and talking about predominantly white people. So as I often like to say to some people, you've spent 400 years researching me, now I want to spend some time researching you. So critical race theory is a really important framework to do so. It is American. However, we need to understand the construct of America. America really is the byproduct of various European colonization. So we can't think about America without thinking about it on a transnational political scale in relation to British and Britishness. So most of my research is really unpicking Tate Britain, about effectively asking who is that Britain in Tate Britain. And we need to think about the empire being this kind of system of, you know, multiculturalism, multi-ethnicities, religion, skin tones for about a good part of 300 years. But yet the British story around multiculturalism starts in 1948, i.e. the arrival of the Windrush and others, various kind of people of colour from the colonies. But yet we have artwork that depicts black and brown bodies as early as the 1600s in London. So it really does kind of create a particular temporality of how we think about the race, the historical racialization of Britain, using Tate Britain as this site where artwork is supposedly meant to tell the British story. So it means that I do use vocabulary like white supremacy to think about systems and practices and structures that are global, or whiteness as an identity construct. And I use white skin privilege because it also acknowledges that even if you are not white, you can be white adjacent and white passing and benefit from white privilege. My main epistemology is a black feminist lens. I feel like someone made a comment about not having a choice. I don't have a choice. It has to be a black feminist lens. it can't be nothing but that, because if it isn't, I'm completely desituating myself out of my own research. I'm saying that I don't exist if I don't use that as a vocabulary to think and theorise and understand the world. And I think I use white supremacy across, not just on race, but gender. We need to understand that gender is a construct of colonisation, sexuality is a construct of colonisation, and class is a construct of colonisation. So white supremacy is, for me, this overarching historical imperial construct that's actually navigated and defined the world in very rigid binaries. So I will be using white supremacy, but don't think of it in terms of a racialisation of white supremacy. Always think race, gender, class, and bodies. So I'm going to quickly skip over this because I've kind of made it really clear. So I just use this quote by Patricia Hill Collins, because for me it does effectively what it says on the tin, that actually the way in which I know and understand the world through my various kind of beings is not seen as knowledge. So the use of personal examples is knowledge, actually. I experience and know the world because the world experiences and knows me in a particular kind of way. It's phenomenology. We have a whole discourse within it, within the philosophical understanding of it. So personal stories are hugely important as narratives to understand how different people understand and relate to the world, and how we also have a particular subjectivity. And actually, being subjective is not a bad thing. And I'll come on to that a bit later, because I'm going to start unpicking some of this language around rational, objective, logical, illogical. And who does that really serve? And who does it actually, who are the people who get experience a huge amount of disservice in that kind of vocabulary? So I like this quote. I feel like it really speaks to me. And it's because it's true. I was actually in my second last year, when I was doing like a mini viva to transfer from an MPhil to my PhD program, these two white male people who were examining my work created a whole new framework to mark my work, and I failed. So I did not follow the university's guidelines of how my work should be marked, both in the written format and in my oral presentation, but created a whole new way because it really made them feel uncomfortable. I was talking about white supremacy, did not cite Foucault, though I do here in this presentation, and I was failed on a criteria that I didn't even know existed. But for me, that's a metaphor of my life. I'm often failed on criteria that I don't know exist. And perhaps a lot of people might kind of relate to that. So that's my personal space. I am not a traditional academic. I did not do my undergraduate. I did not then do my MA, and I did not do my PhD. I'm 32, so I've worked in between those moments. And I've always worked within the women's sector. So I've always worked predominantly with young women who've experienced sexual abuse. So my framework and understanding of safety comes from perhaps a very different lived experience or understanding of what safety means and who safety really serves. And that's what I want us to think about as well. So from my experience of both reading and being in the university space, universities are contested spaces. And perhaps that's perhaps nothing new for a lot of people. So I'm going to really unpick that actually universities, and I work in an art and design environment, which is meant to be very liberal, which is meant to be very radical and forward thinking, but is the complete opposite when you think about how the echelon of power and who gets to make policies, who gets to make decisions, and how we're actually completely not even in communication with the local community. I basically work at LCC, we're in Elephant and Castle, and we're part of a whole redevelopment plan to take down a shopping centre that served predominantly a Latin community for about 30 years. And the university doesn't particularly give a shit. So, and it's all part of the university moving forward to have a bigger building, to expand, have more courses, effectively have more students, and ultimately to make more money. So even at that point, we need to think about who in that space is are completely disadvantaged by the expansion and growth of the London College of Communication and who benefits. So understanding that universities are sites of privilege, understanding that they are inherently built of Enlightenment philosophies, which are completely rooted in colonial and patriarchal discourses, understanding that particular epistemology is predominantly white, understanding there's a particular sense of culture that does not necessarily feel good for me, but might feel good for a lot of people who do not look like me. And understanding the fact that this is the reason why we only have 25 black female professors in the UK. And this does pertain a particular kind of safety or unsafety, depending on who you are and how you are situated against these bigger political paradigms. One of my slides that you might be able to read. So I want to spend some time, but not too much time, talking about the enlightenment, because it's really important to think about the way in which we teach and how we teach and from what position. So enlightenment philosophy, perhaps some people are familiar with it. It's, you know, this period of time from the 1600s up until the 1800s where, you know, predominantly white European men from France and Germany and the UK are thinking very differently about the world. They're divorcing themselves from being ordained by God. And actually, you know, all this knowledge comes from me. You know, they're looking at the world in a particular kind of way. But what we often don't understand is that their ability to understand and frame and create academic discourses is completely in tandem with the colonial process of literally collecting and gathering information about the world. So the reason why we have studies like anthropology or botany or ethnography is literally down to colonizers going out, collecting plants, collecting people, collecting animals, collecting artifacts to rationalize their inferiority to then create white Western European superiority. So universities are literally built on this premise of, in its kind of literally foundations, inequality. And inequality for a particular group of people. So when we think about the spaces that we navigate, whether it's libraries, archives, museums, galleries, universities, they're all part of the same thread. They're all part of privileged a particular kind of critical pedagogical modality that effectively say that if you're not a white man, you're not a theorist. The amount of times I've had people walk into my classroom and ask where the teacher is. And I'm standing like this by the presentation and people say, oh, where's the teacher? This, but it comes from a place, because as a black woman, I'm not seen as someone who is a knowledge holder, who is a knowledge producer and a knowledge maker, because it disrupts the paradigms of who gets to be in that subjective position. It's not people who look like me or share any sense of identities as me. And Sylvia Winter, who perhaps people may or may not know, is an amazing Jamaican academic who does not have a PhD and has particularly chose not to do this tenured position, writes often about who gets to be human, who gets to have access to humanity. And it's often, and she really does this amazing, she's very complex in her writing, but you know, go flow with her. She does this amazing of constantly charting back to Enlightenment philosophies of how there is a complete hierarchy of human status. And effectively, if you're white, a white woman, a white working class person, a person of colour, woman of colour, and so forth, you do not have human status. And if you don't have human status, you do not have access to emotionality. So therefore, you're not seen. You're not heard. You're not listened to. You do not speak. So constantly need to remind ourselves that these makes universities contested spaces, and that ultimately universities are not neutral, they're not objective. In fact, they're the complete opposite. They reinforce a lot of objectivity or supposed objectivity, because when we unpick objectivity, from whose lens are we saying who is objective and subjective? And often objectivity is seen as a very white male patriarchal lens. I'm always seen as subjective or emotional. I can't be rational, I can't be logical, because that is a space and domain that I am not allowed to occupy under this kind of very colonial, white supremacist, patriarchal discourse. So therefore, we need to then think about how this is also a language or part of modernity, that you're meant to be part of this way of looking forward and being progressive when you're objective. You're unfeeling. You don't recognise that you might be nervous, as I say, or you don't recognise there's something happening, because recognizing those feelings then puts you into a feminine domain. It puts you into the domain of not being rational, because rational, logical, objective is always a masculine paradigm domain, and feminine, illogical, that's the domain that women and often people of colour are often positioned as. I'm getting to this is why safety is really why we shouldn't do safety. So if this is the positionality of how curriculums work, how university spaces work, then who is safety really for? Who gets to be safe under this particular kind of language? And let's kind of go back. Safety as a kind of wider political discourse really begins post-2000 with 9/11, right? Of constantly keeping the nation state safe. So it's inherently connected to supposed terrorism of these brown others are going to come and somehow take away our Western civil liberties if we don't keep them in check, if we don't also enforce police control on the bodies that are in this supposed Western space. So for me, safety is really about maintaining hegemonic oppression. It's about saying if you're white, male, cis, able-bodied citizen, you get to be safe because the features, the paradigm, the legislations and laws that exist ultimately upsell safety for these people. But if you are someone who experiences oppression, whether it's intersectionally, you are not safe because oppression is something that is always lurking. I may not ever experience someone's thoughts about me, but I may not be safe around them, even if they don't enact those thoughts or say anything to me. I'm going to forward a few slides. So we don't often think about oppressors, but in that language, safety really does uphold oppression. So this is not to call out King's College or anything. I literally just Googled university safe space policy, and this is the first one that came up. But I think this is actually very representative of a lot of policies that exist in student unions, is that when we list supposed protected characteristics like race, gender, class, sexuality, disability, we're not specifying if this is on the side of dominance or oppression. And if you recently read the news, there's supposedly a young white man who sued the Metropolitan Police for failing to get a job, and he used the fact that he was white, male and straight for being discriminated against. So this is how the law works, that effectively anyone, even if someone with a dominant identity, can still supposedly experience oppression. It doesn't serve really to protect the people that are experiencing on the ground marginalisation. So we need to then think about where does safety exist. So we know that safety exists institutionally because there's policies and quality diversity. We know there's laws that people have to, you know, universities and public spaces have to refer to. There's ontology of the staff in the curriculum, the student population. Then there's the bigger, wider social political discourses that impact safety or unsafety for people. And then there's the idea of relationships. How do we navigate our own sense of agency, even amongst these kind of multi-setting, multi-dimensional ways where safety is somehow given to a group, small group of people, i.e. privileged people, and those who are not. So safety really is about maintaining comfort. It's actually not about disrupting the status quo. It's about saying if you're coming to a safe space, you're here to be comforted, you're here to be made safe, you're here not to be disturbed in any kind of way. It's about keeping hegemonic oppression intact, even if it is a space that's meant to be for oppressed people. So when you are organising or coming together, or when I'm speaking about white supremacy, I won't have time for my story and I won't have time for this, we're actually enacting bravery. Because there's nothing safe for me even saying what I'm saying to you right now. There's nothing safe when I'm using the word white supremacy in an art school when I'm constantly told not to. There's nothing safe when students are gathering together to challenge, you know, why is their curriculum white, or to think about decolonization. There's nothing safety in that because you're constantly disrupting the tide of hegemonic oppression. There is a lot of bravery though. You are being very brave. You are actually willing to speak out, willing to maybe risk your place at university, willing to lose your job even. So when we actually start unpicking this language of safety, we always need to be asking ourselves, who are we really serving here and who gets lost? And are we really serving the people that we seek to protect? Or are we in this kind of use of pulling on neoliberal discourses, really surfing privilege and dominance? So, do I have any time left?
You do have
3 minutes left. Okay, let's go back to the sides. So, the reason why I say this is because it's important to think about how knowledge is embodied, right? So, you know, we learn a lot from our senses, from our families, from the culture that we come from, and we enact a lot of that into the classroom. I was struggling to think of examples for this presentation, and two things happened in this 1 week. I had a young, I teach hip hop studies as part of contextual studies at LCC, and I had a young black guy who shouldn't be in my class but turns up every week, and I'm like, you know what, you're here, I'm not gonna rat you out. Like, you wanna be here, you're here. And we were talking about toxic masculinity, and he was like, Janine, but like, I can't take this to the mandem. How do I take toxic masculinity to the mandem? I was like, well, let's open that up. How do you, as a young black boy, young black man from Deptford, South London, who is moving in between two spaces, one in a white liberal university space which upholds middle classness, and then going back to a predominantly black working class space where you're learning all of this thing, you're challenging your own sense of masculinity, but you're also expected to reinforce a particular type of masculinity with your predominantly black or other, you know, ethnic group of friends. That's actually really hard. That creates a lot of tension for that young man. And so, well, I was like, yeah, let's open up. How do we bring what you are learning in this space with me to a group of people who don't have the opportunity to get to university? How do we navigate that politics for that young man? But literally, what language can he use to serve for his friendships? Equally, at the end of the lecture, I had a young white girl come up to me and was like, Janine, I need to talk to you. I thought, oh my God, maybe, you know, she can't do that. I don't know. She's like, I think I'm racist. So I was like, okay. You know, I was like, I'm literally trying to get to another classroom, and she's like walking with me, and I was like, okay, let's walk and talk. She's like, I think I'm racist. Like, what happened? She's like, I cross the road whenever I see black men. And I was like, yeah, that is quite racist. It is. I'm not going to lie to her. And I said, why do you do that? She goes, because I come from a part of town where I haven't really actually interacted with black people before. And I was like, then I want you to go and think about that, actually. Like, where does that come from? Where does you seeing a group of people that makes you want to cross the road, because where does that fear come from? And so she went back and she emailed me, and she's like, she did all this reading. I was like, great. She's like, I think she's like, am I always going to be racist? And I was like, I can't answer that question for you. Like, I literally can't. Because what she's seeking there is a bit of protection in her fragility. She wants me as a black person to say, no, you're fine, you're a good white person, effectively. So I was like, that's something for you to navigate, but it kind of speaks to this emotional labour that I'm expected to perform, bearing in mind I'm the only black person in my department that no one else will have to deal with. So I'm going to end there, because I think I have no time. But